Not only does Ray Bradbury have 500 short stories, novels, plays, and poems to his credit, he may be the only writer around with astral connections, because when the Apollo astronaut team landed on the moon, they named the Dandelion Crater after one of his novels. His books may not be on the moon, but they enjoy a very wide circulation, having been published in some 20 countries around the world. And now the master storyteller has done it again with A Graveyard for Lunatics, a madcap novel with a series of oddball characters set in Hollywood circa 1954. It's just being released by Alfred A. Knopf, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome this legendary figure to New York
pleasure.
And Company.
Thank you.
How do I mean, did that thing on the moon excite you in any way?
Oh, yes, of course, because I went down to Cape Canaveral and to Houston 25 or 26 years ago, and I met all the astronauts before they went into space, before the Apollo missions began. And Time Life sent me down to write an article about all this. And, of course, I was bombarded with millions of facts, and I called Life and said, fire me. And they said, why? I said, because I don't understand what I'm seeing. There's too much. And they said, we believe in you. And I said, yes, but I don't believe in myself. How much time do I have? They said, 24 hours. So they forced me, in a way, into finishing the article. And that was my beginning with the Apollo people. And the excitement is still there.
Mm-hmm. I understand that two of your biggest fans are Raisa and Mikhail Gorbachev. They invited you to lunch at the Soviet embassy during the last visit.
Yep. And
did
their
you go?
Daughter, too. Their daughter was mainly responsible. And when I was introduced to Gorbachev, he said, our daughter thinks you're the greatest writer in the world. And I said, keep her. That's a good daughter.
I know you don't like to fly. So what do you do with the $10 million in rubles that have piled up in a Moscow bank account from royalties from your books?
Well, I've learned to fly recently. Maybe that's one of the reasons I'm going to go get it.
You're going to spend it all in the Soviet Union?
I'm going to get invited over sometime next year because they've been stealing my books and publishing them for 35 years or so. And the money is accrued. And also they've been adapting my stories into films mm-hmm. and television. They've done the Martian Chronicles there without permission. So the other day when I met some Soviet TV people, I suggested, why don't you put on a Ray Bradbury festival, all these plagiarized works, and invite me over next year, and I'll come. I mean, after all, they're just sitting there.
I have a feeling that the reason they like you and so many people who are not necessarily science fiction fans like you is because your books have a more serious or more realistic basis. I don't want to say serious because they're often quite funny, but a more realistic basis than some. And there's a big debate over whether much of what is called science fiction should really be called fantasy or something else.
It's a mixture. I'm a writer of poetry, basically, and who got into writing fiction when he was in his teens. But I started out as a poet, as an actor, and as a collector of comic strips and a lover of movies. That mm-hmm. all shows up in my work. So I think my work is easily assimilable by people because it's full of metaphors. I've been taught by the Bible and by Alexander Pope and Shakespeare, and that makes for a better style. A magic realism, sort of.
And the movies have major influence in that?
The way
you like to manipulate time and all?
Starting when I was two or three, my mother took me to all the early silent films, so I have a complete education there. And then when I was older, by the time I was in high school, I was seeing anywhere from 5 to 10 to 18 movies a week because mm-hmm. I was crazy for them. So that's all put away. It's all in my bloodstream. And when I got into my 30s, it was easy for me to become a screenwriter because I'd put in all that education.
You talked about a film being made from one of your stories in the Soviet Union without credit. You wrote a story once in which a man is in danger of destroying the future by coming out of the past. And I wonder what you thought of Back to the Future when you saw that.
I try not to see these films. Well, these are all my children. A lot of these are my children. And I understand when I meet them, they say, Steven Spielberg calls me Papa mm-hmm. because I influenced Close Encounters of a Third Kind. When I met him for the first time the morning after one of the first previews, I went out to the studio to show him the book review, the film review I'd done on the film. And he says, how do you like your picture? I said, what do you mean? He says, Close Encounters of a Third Kind would never have been made if you hadn't written It Came from Outer Space. Hmm. So he's one of my sons, and a lot of these other people are too. And so you accept the fact that if you were Papa, your children have got to be influenced by you, and that's swell.
This book has a real nostalgic tone to it. There are plot twists like traditional horror films, and many of the names are nods at Hollywood greats like Fritz Wong, which obviously emerging Fritz Lang and James Wong Howe.
That's correct.
Because you got started in writing movies in 1952, here you have a book that takes place in 1954. Is this a way of going back into your past?
Yeah, it's. I've always wanted to do a book on Hollywood. The challenge, of course, is to try to equal an unfinished book, The Last Tycoon by Fitzgerald, F. Scott Fitzgerald. But it's an incomplete book, and we've all tried to guess at what it would have been had he lived longer. And then you have books by Bud Schulberg and others. Everyone's trying to write the Hollywood epic. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me the best way to do it is through a murder mystery. Then you have all the fun of the murders and what have you, and you can use the sound stages, and you can go to every country of the world. That we read mystery stories for two reasons. We learn to be educated, because any good murder mystery educates you to some to antiques, if it's an antique murder, or the Orient Express, if it's on the Orient Express. So you're taking in information as well as being entertained. So I thought it would be fun to write a novel about the studios that I grew up around. I used to hang around Paramount on my roller skates when I was 13, and around Columbia and all the big restaurants and the Hollywood Legion Stadium for the fights on Friday nights. And I got to know George Burns along the way when I was 14.
One of the people you dedicate the book to.
That's right, because he encouraged me in my writing. I turned in scripts to the Burns and Allen show every Wednesday night for about a year there when I was 14. And I'm sure George never read them. He may have glanced at them because they were dreadful. But he didn't tell me they were dreadful. He told me I was a fine writer. And that encouraged me to continue. So I couldn't help but dedicate the book to him along with all these lovely people that I knew.
And here you get a chance to use movie techniques in a novel. Special effects, for example, play a part in this plot.
2 months, 30 years ago, I worked with Margaret Booth, who's one of the great film editors. She helped start MGM Studios back in 1922 when it was next to a zoo or in a zoo. I can't remember which. But I've known her now for 30 years, and I learned more from her in 8 weeks about filmmaking than I learned from all the other people I've ever known. So she's in the book.
This studio, of course, is not next to a zoo. It's next to a graveyard.
That's right. That's Paramount, actually. And Paramount has a wall across the backside, and on the other side of the wall is the graveyard. So you have a tale of two cities, the city of light and the city of darkness. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, both cities are the same. Huh?
Did people working at Paramount at that time recognize that, or is this something that you've seen in retrospect?
No one ever talked about it, but it always struck me as intriguing that right across the wall, Douglas Fairbanks was buried later, of course, because when I was hanging around, he was still alive. But Rudy Valentino was there, and a lot of other people. Tyrone Power is buried there. So they have this strange attraction, which comes from the movie people being on both sides of the wall.
My guest is Ray Bradbury, who really does not need any further explanation. His latest book is A Graveyard for Lunatics, and it's published by Knopf, and it's a return to the novel after years of playing
four,
with it.
4 years, yeah.
What makes you decide whether to write something as a screenplay, as a short story, as a novel?
I don't decide. My subconscious, my muse, whatever you want to call it, you wake up one day and suddenly you want to do something, so I always go with it. Mm-hmm. This particular novel started on its own because I went overseas 4 years ago on the Elizabeth II, and on the way over, I encountered a man on board the ship who had an incredibly destroyed face. I don't know how it was destroyed, whether it was genetic, whether he was in an accident, but the second after he passed me on board ship, I burst into tears. I was so deeply affected by him having to live with his face. I saw him at dinner every night for five nights, sitting across from me about 30 feet away. And he was laughing and having a wonderful time with his wife and daughter. And I looked at this, I said, my God, what a great gift love is. He's forgotten his face, and they've forgotten it, huh? So when I got to Paris, I was haunted by that face. And I sat in my hotel room for 10 nights with a completely silent, battery-operated typewriter and with my wife asleep nearby. And in the dark, without seeing my fingers, I typed the first 100 pages of this novel. And it finished itself within a year without my knowing who this man was. And I still don't know. And I don't want to know.
Because you can be inspired in that way, you've never really had a problem with writer's block? Or do you turn them out so fast that you can still do all of this and suffer?
Well, the thing is, everything should be play. Everything should be love. And you should never do things to be popular. You shouldn't do things for money. You should do things because it's great fun. So as long as you do that, you'll never have writer's block. The people who get writer's block are people who are doing things they shouldn't be doing, and their subconscious is telling them, don't do it. If we all wore around our necks, typed in reverse, a little sign we looked at every morning, which says, stop that, huh? Stop that. Whatever you're doing, don't do it, because that makes writer's block. You're having a love affair you shouldn't be having. You're in a job you shouldn't be in. You're eating food you shouldn't be eating. Whatever it is, stop it. And if we all followed those rules, we'd have a healthy world and good relationships with ourselves. Huh?
Does everything you start wind up becoming a finished piece, or do you have a lot of false starts?
It sometimes becomes a poem, then later it becomes a one-act play, then it becomes a short story. I have a musical opening in Los Angeles in September. I've written with Jose Feliciano, The Wonderful Ice Cream Suit. Well, it started as an idea when I lived in a tenement 45 years ago in L.A. with a lot of Hispanics and a certain element of Jewish, a certain amount of Oriental, and a number of white trash, huh? And I wrote a short story, which I sold to the Saturday Evening Post 33 years ago. The next year, I wrote it as a television comedy with Peter Falk playing a role in it, in one of his first performances on television, live. And then I did it as a one-act play, and now I've done it as a two-act musical comedy.
Does it go through a lot of changes? Because this is something...
No, the essence is always the same. If the idea is good, let me give you a quick idea of what I do when an idea hits me. I was watching television a couple of weeks ago, and they had an announcement about an aviator who had just died, and 40 years or so before that, in World War II, his jet was shot down. He bailed out. His parachute saved him. And when he got married 5 years later, his bride-to-be said to him, "Where's the parachute?" And he brought her the parachute, and she made it into a bridal gown. Well, I mean, that's so beautiful, isn't it? I mean, you love that woman, don't you, for giving that gift and wanting that part of him that saved his life. So as soon as I heard that on the show, I turned off the set and ran and wrote the poem. Mm-hmm. In the instant, you must always do these things when you're on fire.
Your first published work was when you were 20. If you look back at that today, still feel, that's fine?
It's a pretty good, it was a comic article, a story about a man who went around killing people who spoke cliches. And the title of the story was, "It's Not the Heat, It's the Hue." Well, before the man could finish the humidity, the guy shot him. You know, he couldn't stand any more cliches.
Well, luckily that guy isn't around anymore. All talk radio would be wiped out in no time. Ray Bradbury's latest book is called A Graveyard for Lunatics, subtitled Another Tale of Two Cities. It's published by Alfred A. Knopf, and we will continue our conversation right after this. My guest is Ray Bradbury, whose latest book is A Graveyard for Lunatics, Another Tale of Two Cities, published by Alfred Knopf. And this book merges most of his interests over the years, a mixture of fantasy, of movies, of all sorts of elements that surprise. And at the same time, it's grounded in in a certain amount of reality.
I think that's an important thing in yours. A good part of the novel. If people want to read my autobiography, they can find it in this book and in my other murder mystery, Death is a Lonely Business, because a lot of the little incidents in here are things that happened to me at the studio, and I found them of great use in the structure of the novel. For instance, when I was at MGM, they called me in one day, and they said, we've just finished King of Kings, the new version with Jeffrey Hunter playing Christ. And they said, we want to hire you. I said, for what? They said, we have no ending for the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, have you tried the Bible? And they said,
they didn't
yes,
like that ending.
Yes, but he said, we want Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Ray. And I said, okay. So I wrote the narration for the film. And
the one
I
that Orson Welles speaks.
Orson Welles spoke my narration.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they didn't give him credit, though. He wanted $25,000. For the use of his name, and they didn't want to pay it, which is ridiculous. They should have.
Mm-hmm.
And my narration is not credited on the film either. The screenwriter wouldn't allow it, and, which is a shame, too, because I contributed to the film. It needed a narration. And I found an ending for the film in the Book of John, a combination of the things I found there, and I think in Mark. But they didn't use that ending. They chopped it up.
Well, this is not the only non-science fiction thing that you've done. You also wrote the script for Moby Dick. In fact, does it bother you that people immediately think Ray Bradbury science fiction when so many of the things that you've done have been in other genres?
Yeah,
you've tried
yeah.
virtually everything.
I'm waiting for them to drop the label someday because it never really applied when it began. I started out in Weird Tales when I was 22 years old. And that is fantasy. It's not science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Science fiction is based on physics, on reality, on real things that are happening or can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And the history of ideas. And fantasy, weird tales, are something else again. It's the impossible. Science fiction is always the art of the possible.
Is the narrator speaking for you in this book when he says that Thomas Mann and Goethe would be unable to write a decent screenplay?
Yeah. Because we each have our own talents. I'm a great lover of Death in Venice and Mario and the Magician, a lot of other things by Mann. But he can write those stories. I can't write Mario and the Magician. I can't do Death in Venice.
Mm-hmm.
Almost maybe, but Thomas Mann has that whole field to himself. And I can dominate over in the screenwriting because it's very special. And a novel is not a screenplay. And a lot of novelists who try to do screenplays can't. But luckily, I grew up with all these thousands of films in my background, and that helped me.
And in fact, Thomas Mann's work has not really adapted very well to films, yet Ray Bradbury, how many movies have been made from your books?
Oh, about a dozen, and then I've done, in television, I've done about 50,
You have
maybe
a series
60.
On the USA Network.
Well, 42 on the network. We've just finished 8 new ones in New Zealand and 4 in Canada.
Uh-huh.
With James Whitmore and Sally Kellerman and Robert Culp and David Carradine. We've got a lot of good people, and we've won a lot of awards. I'm very proud of the series.
Are you happy with the films that have been made from your books? Fahrenheit 451 was
done
by Francois Truffaut.
Yeah, that's a good one.
What about some of the others? The Martian Chronicles, The Illustrated Man.
The Martian Chronicles on NBC was a bore.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't bad. It just it needed someone to come in and hit the actors with a whip. And say, you know, move, say something, you know, don't just stand there.
Have you ever wanted to be a director since you've been
so involved? Yeah, but I have such respect for the form, and I know I can't get up at 5 in the morning, and they all have to. I used to live next door to Bill Scull, who was one of the great cinematographers, and I got to know him and his wife very much.
Another
very
guy
well.
You dedicate this book
and,
to.
And my story, Lafayette Farewell, and my other book, Toynbee Convector, is all about Bill. But every morning at 5 o'clock, my bedroom was right below their bedroom, up which was a little higher where we lived. And every morning the light would come on in his bedroom and it would shine on my pillow. And I thought, oh my God, he's going to work. And I'm going to stay here for 3 more hours. And I knew then I could never be a director because it's a 20-hour-a-day job. You never have any social life.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get to go to movies.
But you also get to have the movie turn out the way you wanted. I'm sure there are times when you see a film from one of your books where you say, gee, why did they do that to me?
It's tempting. because I know how to milk the cow. In other words, you go to a really good Hitchcock film, and you just watch how he lays in the information, point by point. He keeps you waiting just the right amount, not too much, not too little. He's not successful all the time, but his great films, boy, oh boy, and he knows exactly what frame to cut and what to linger over. So I've learned from the master, and I was lucky to work on his show 30 years ago. I did 9 scripts. And then I worked with Rod Serling.
That way, you were already famous when you were working on this, weren't you?
Not really. You know, notorious, maybe. But most of my reputation has come in the last 10 years. I feel.
Really?
I
hate to say I grew up reading your books.
Well, you see, I've never been a bestseller. My books sell moderately well. My Martian Chronicles, when it came out, hardcover, 7,000 copies. Illustrated Man, 8,000 copies.
Really?
It's only in recent years. Now, this new murder mystery may very well sell between 30 and 40,000, maybe 50,000 copies hardcover. But that's not a bestseller. That's not Harold Robbins' time, is it?
No.
Nor would I want it to be. Yeah.
The narrator is almost afraid of meeting his gods in the movie business in the commissary. You hung around when you were a kid. Did you feel that way, too? Were you afraid of them?
I'm sorry, I missed part of that.
Your narrator is afraid of meeting his gods in the commissary. No?
I don't think so.
Oh.
Yeah.
There aren't a lot of women in your stories. Is there a reason for that?
Well, there are. If you look at Fahrenheit 451, there are two women, two different kinds of women.
You think your most serious book? That book is about book burning and.
Dear me, I hate serious books. I hope it isn't a serious book. It's an adventure. It's a James Bond adventure in many ways, which has a point to it, huh? I don't want to pontificate. I don't want to teach. I don't want to do anything that's good for anyone. A book has to be good in its own right. And then if you get something out of it, swell. But I hate intellectual people who go around teaching in the world. I don't want to be a teacher.
As you said earlier, you want to have fun.
Huh?
You said earlier you want to have fun.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. I try to teach people, if you're unhappy, look to the reasons. Look to the root system. Are you doing something you shouldn't be doing? Stop it tonight. Go get another job. Take a chance. There's no guarantees. I take a chance every day of my life. No one pays me to write what I write. It's all written free. People don't seem to know that. I write a short story free. No one pays me for it. When I finish it finally, I send it out and it sells or it doesn't sell. So I'm still getting rejections this late in life.
You don't get big advances?
No, I don't take advances. Yeah.
Ray Bradbury has published some 25 books, novels, stories, plays, essays, and poems, numerous film scripts. His collaborations with John Huston are legendary. And his most recent book is called A Graveyard for Lunatics, Another Tale of Two Cities. It's published by Alfred Knopf. It's been a great pleasure having Ray Bradbury on New York & Company. Thank you so much.
Thank you.